I'm so thankful for the gospel message that someone shared with me years ago. I'm grateful. It never gets old to hear how wonderful it is that Jesus saves us. And I trust that you have no fear, that you don't have to have any fear of death, but that you know in your heart that you'll live eternally one day with the Lord. Well, we have been studying through the book of Acts, and we're in our last two chapters. We have this week. And then we have next week, and we will conclude our time in the book of Acts. It's been about a year and a half that we've studied the book of Acts, and I think today is a very vivid narrative that the Holy Spirit of God has recorded for us, because I think it is tremendous in what the message in the life of the Apostle Paul is. Acts chapter 27 is about a shipwreck. And the idea of being overtaken out at sea by a storm isn't something that just really excites me. I am not really a sailor. I haven't really been out on ships that often. When Kathy and I were on our honeymoon, we went and took a boat ride to see Pearl Harbor, and I didn't do well. The day was kind of spent with me not feeling well after that little boat ride, but I can't not even imagine being out when there's a massive storm going on. And yet movies have been made about this because it gives such intrigue and danger, and TV shows have become very popular, showing the danger on the sea, whether folks are out there defending whales or catching lobster and crabs. People are glued to it with, wow, can you believe they can even stay on that boat? Books, both fictional and real, have been written about ships lost at sea. Poems have been written or formed. Songs have been sung. And yet you think, man, if I could just be out there and see the beautiful ocean, the sun sparkling, everything is calm, it looks beautiful. But yet, even though as beautiful it looks, it needs to be given great respect. There have been many who have died at sea. With that thought in mind, it's interesting to look at Revelation chapter 21. When it talks about the new heaven, the new earth, what the writer John said that he noticed that there was not in the new heaven, the new earth, is that there would be no more sea, no more ocean. And that would be another message at another time, but I've always thought that was interesting. In Acts 27, we find the story of the shipwreck of the Apostle Paul. I googled shipwrecks, storms at sea, and sea survivors. Wow. Can I tell you, there is a lot of information out there in that regard. Obviously, Paul could not Google shipwrecks, how to survive at sea, but he had firsthand experience. According to 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 25, it says he was shipwrecked three different times, and a night and a day he actually was in the deep. So surviving shipwrecks was something that the Apostle Paul was a little used to, but probably he wasn't exactly that excited about having to continually experience the aspect of being on a vessel and it wrecks at sea. But as I was Googling that, I found some incredible stories. One aspect that I thought was interesting was this. I didn't find, and I'm not saying they're not out there, but I wasn't able to find where people started out in a ship that went through a severe storm or accident, that everyone on the ship survived at the end. I wasn't able to find that. I found one. There's five men from Mexico that unfortunately have the dubious award in the record books for being on the ocean trying to survive for the longest period of time. I mean, we're familiar with the stories like the Titanic. We usually don't hear too often about five guys who went out to try to catch shark. They got out there. They're in the just off the coast of Mexico. And unbelievably, they ran out of gas. They tried to get their oars and paddle back, but they got in a current that just kept taking them to the open sea. And pretty soon, they were in the Pacific. And they actually drifted 5,500 miles over the next 9 months. They finally were discovered off the northern coast of Australia. Five of them didn't make it. Just three made that 9-month journey and survived it. Someone says, man, how did they survive? There were all kinds of things written on how they survived it, but the one that caught my attention was that they ate 103 sea turtles in the span of 9 months. They returned to their village, and the people looked at them and said, it is a miracle. Well, this chapter in the book of Acts is miraculous in its own right. It has much value to us today because it teaches us concerning the providence of God. We see really who is in control. As easily as Jesus Christ could claim the wind and the waves, and he could calm them, so easily can God stir them up for his own end. Someone once said, the true metal of a man or a woman comes in the fires of testing. We get to see exactly who they are and how they respond. Paul had experienced many crises in his life, but just in this journey alone, from Caesarea to Rome, listen to what he experienced. He experienced sickness, a massive storm, obviously the wind and the waves that go with that, hunger, sword-bearing soldiers, and finally next week we'll see a poisonous snake attack. I think that was just in one journey he had. I think, man, I didn't have that bad of a week. Acts 27, a literal storm. This morning I would like to view it as a symbol of storms that come into our lives as believers, maybe daily or weekly or monthly. And don't get me wrong, we're going to dive into this passage because in Acts chapter 27, our focus this morning will really be on verses 21 through 44, but I want to just make some observations as we read through this. So if you have your Bibles, I would invite you to read along with me here. And right off the bat, we see that Luke's narrative here is very descriptive. He's one who was familiar with the sea. He was familiar with sailing. But because Luke was aboard this ship, the passage was written from his personal experience, thus making it very accurate and vivid. In fact, there have been books written on how to handle ships in the open water based on Acts chapter 27. We find right away in verse 1, when it was decided that we is the first time we find Luke saying, I'm right there with you, since chapter 18 and verse 21. Someone says, well, you mean he wasn't there all the other times? Well, he was probably in Caesarea, but remember when Paul was in prison, he probably had opportunities to come and go and was probably keeping tabs and checking on what was taking place in the life of the Apostle Paul. But you don't see him being right there as he is right at this point. And it says, we should sail to Italy to deliver Paul and some other prisoners. That's an interesting aspect in the Greek too. Other prisoners. Others of a different kind. Different than the Apostle Paul. These guys are true criminals. They're probably sailing over to Rome either to be tried or possibly even executed. And their execution many times would be throw them out there into the arena. People pay money to watch the animals come in and devour them. But he says, other prisoners, to one named Julius, a centurion. He was over 100 men of the Augustan regiment. So entering a ship of Adramyttium, we put to sea, meaning to sail along the coast of Asia. Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, he was with us. Now, can I just stop here for a second? There is no way that a prisoner under Roman jurisdiction would be able to have anyone jump on board with him to sail to Italy, to Rome, to meet Caesar. They're not going to be able to take anybody with them. However, we find two, Luke and Aristarchus, they go with them. There's only two ways that could have happened. One, they were both willing to become slaves of Saul. If they became a slave of Saul, then they would take them. I think of that just for a second. I mean, this is not some cruise line that they're going to be able to have a great, enjoyable experience on. This is going to be some sort of cargo ship that's probably carrying wheat and rice over to Rome, and they're going to go through all kinds of difficulties, and they were willing to submit themselves. That could have been one. The other could have been Festus just knowing the innocency of Paul, sent out a letter saying, let his two companions go with him. But for whatever reason, we find that they go with him. And I think when I look at their willingness to love and to minister the Apostle Paul, I came across this quote. It said, brotherly love is not just a question of feeling, but it's a question of sacrifice. They were willing to sacrifice for their friend. And so we pick it up in verse 3. And the next day, we landed at Sidon. And Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. Here's what's interesting. I love the New King James writing here. Treated Paul and then received care. These are medical terms that you would find in the Greek. In other words, Paul is not doing well physically. He is sick. And can you blame him with everything he's been going through? I mean, the up and the down of, am I going to be tried? Now I'm put in this prison. I've been beaten. And so Paul was going through some time. And Julius gave him an opportunity to go and be ministered to by his friends. Verse 4, and we put to sea from there. We sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. They were hitting him right in the face. The winds were coming west. They tried to stay as close as they could to land. And when we had sailed over the sea, which is off Cilicia, remember, that's where Paul was from, Pamphylia, we came to Myra, or a city of Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy, and he put us on board. The other ship they'd probably been on up at this time was probably smaller, staying close to the island. Here, they're getting put on a big boat, a big wooden vessel that's going to go open sea. And when we had sailed slowly many days, I don't know why that phrase stood out to me, but for people like ourselves that we're in a hurry, need to get it done, need to get there, this just stood out. They sailed slowly many days, and they arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, the wind not permitting us to proceed. We sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salamone. Passing it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens near the city of Lycia. Now, Fair Havens, we're going to find that the Chamber of Commerce of Fair Havens must have come up with this name. Because we're going to find that Fair Havens was not a Fair Haven place to be. They didn't want to be there. But they found this place. Now, when much time had been spent, and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, Paul advised him. Paul says in verse 10, saying, man, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also of our lives. Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman, or the captain, and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul. And because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, remember their fair havens, they knew we don't want to hang here, the majority advised to set sail from there also. If by any means they could reach Phoenix, or Phoenicia, a harbor of Crete, opening toward the southwest and northwest, and winter there. And when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their desire, hey, we can make it, putting out to sea, they sailed close by Crete. But not long after, a tempestuous headwind arose called Euroclydon. Now, this was something like a hurricane, typhoon. It was a northeastern wind. It was named. I mean, we name hurricanes today, but this was not like Hurricane Irene. I like Euroclydon. I mean, the boat is getting ready to rock because this wind is going to totally try to destroy it. Verse 15, so when the ship was caught and could not hold into the wind, we let her drive. Now, I'm not a boat person again, so I'm going to have to kind of help you and help myself understand. What do you mean, let it drive? Put it in lower gear. Well, how would you put a boat in lower gear? Well, you take the main sail and you take it down. Maybe you have a couple of smaller sails to try to maintain some sort of balance, but you let the wind take us and we're driving. And running after the shelter off of an island called Clauda, we secured the skiff with difficulty, the dinghy, the little lifeboat that we need to get in case the big boat goes down. I'm sure it was filled with water at this time. But when they had taken it on board, they used cables to undergird the ship. Now, this is talking about the big ship. They didn't have nuts and bolts and welders. They had those that would help as they would put these ships together. They would have more of a sticky substance and try to mold this ship and make it stay based on what they could come up with to fit the boards perfectly together. And But they had a cable running under it, and they could tighten those cables to try to keep the bow and the stern and the boat from breaking apart, because they feared lest they should run aground on the Syrtis sands. They struck sail and were so driven. They got close to an area that was the graveyard of ships. It was a very high sandbar that took many ships down. They thought, we are near this. We have to get out of here. Verse 18, and because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened the ship. On the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands. Now, when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. And that leads us right into what I've entitled our message this morning, Anchors in the Midst of Storms. There's three that I see. You might be able to pick out more, but I saw three here that I think are anchors for us in this day, that I would say are timeless truths for us. And the first being this, the anchor of God's presence in verses 21 to 26. But after long abstinence from food, then Paul stood in the midst of them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss. And now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar. And indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you. Therefore, take heart, men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told me. However, we must run aground on a certain island.'" And what Paul was able to communicate and see is that God is with him, and the same God that was with him is the same God that's with us. It was a reassurance of God's presence. And I'm sure Paul knew God's with me, but he needed that night. It was a great reminder to him. Can I tell you, God has given us wonderful reminders that he's with us today. He'll never leave us. He'll never forsake us. I remember the words of Matthew chapter 28, verse 20, from Jesus himself to his disciples. He said, "Lo, or surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." Can I tell you, I have had times in my life that I just have to say, "God, can I just thank you that you're with me? I'm not praying today that you would be with me." He has promised he will never leave me. He will never forsake me. Many times my prayer might have been what Paul's was, "Lord, make me mindful of your presence in my life." When I live in the reality that God is with me, it should affect the way I live my life. But it was a reassurance to him that God is in control. Parents and grandparents here, or maybe even aunts and uncles, when you've been having small kids over at your place, and boom, massive storm hits. The lightning's flashing, the thunder is rolling, and the wind and the rain, and your kids come running and they go, hey, "I'm scared. Can I sleep with you? Can I be in here with you?" And all of a sudden, of course, yes, come on in with us. And pretty soon they're able to go to sleep, aren't they? Because there's a contentment that there's safety. I'm secure. Someone that I trust and love is in control. And that's how it should be for us. Not only did the angel appear to him, but the angel of the Lord spoke to him. And the message gave him renewed hope, saying, verse 24, "Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar." We read, "Now when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we should be saved was finally given up." He actually, possibly right there with Luke, was like, "This is it. This is the time." And he needed to be reminded, and God brought his angel to remind him. And then Paul challenged the men, "You can be courageous too. I'm telling you, nothing's going to happen to us other than the loss of this ship." And the message gave him a renewed confidence and hope in God's word. And folks, there are going to be people that are going to want to question this book. But when we were singing about it, I don't have to have any other argument. I have Jesus. That is my plea. All I know is he took me from a dirty, rotten sinner. I could not save myself. And Jesus Christ, and the message of Jesus Christ was given to me, Ken Keltner, that you need to receive his free gift. And I put my faith and trust in him. I'm so thankful that I can know for sure I'm going to live with him one day. My confidence and my assurance is going to be in his word. Ladies and gentlemen, he has preserved this for us for generations. We have it. We have the confidence. Paul also knew that God wasn't just with him, but he knew he belonged to God. He said that, I think, in verse 23, the angel of the God to whom I belong. Again, he was committed to the truth of God because of what God had done. I love it. The God whose I am. Can I say this? That's the God of who I belong to. That's why Paul said to the Corinthian church, what? Don't you know? Your body, it's the temple of God. Therefore, glorify God in your body and your spirit, for they're the Lord's. They belong to him. Had a couple one time in Colorado that pulled up after church had been dismissed and everybody had left, and got talking to them. And in time, Andrew came to know Jesus Christ as his personal Savior. Andrew said, we started having this Bible study and discipleship classes. And Andrew said, well, you know, I work at the bar. I didn't know that. He goes, yeah, but I need to talk to you about that. I'm a bouncer at the bar. And he said, you know, we close it all up about 2 a.m. on Sunday morning, but man, I'm here in church. I go, I've noticed it, Andrew. He says, but can I tell you something is bugging me? If I use any kind of profanity, what would you call it? I said, conviction? Yeah, okay, maybe it's conviction. There's something there. This whole drinking thing, man, how do you explain that? I go, well, I said, let me ask you a question. Let me put it in this way for you. What if you're back there with your wife, Heather, in the back of the auditorium, and I come walking in, and I have with me a six-pack of a beer, and I sit back there in the back, and you look over and notice me. I said, what are you going to do? He goes, I'm going to think, what's Ken doing? He knows better than that. Shouldn't be bringing that in here. And during the message, the preacher's preaching, all of a sudden you hear, shh. And you look over there, and I've opened it up. He goes, at that time, I'm probably going to go to the ushers and say, I can throw him out right now. I go, why? He goes, because I know. I haven't even been a Christian that long, and I know you don't do that. I go, here's what you've been going through, because the body is the temple of God. This is where he resides. This is why you've been going through some of those times of conviction in your life. And then the Apostle Paul, with everything we've been seeing, he's been going through in the book of Acts. What? I mean, can't you just imagine him putting his arms out like, don't we remember what he went through for me? That's why in Romans chapter 12, he says, I beg you, brethren, I beseech you by the mercies of God, present your body a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable unto him. When I think of what he's done for me, oh, I mean, and so he knew that he belonged to the Lord. Someone said we belong to God as the bride belongs to the bridegroom. We belong to God as a child belongs to his or her father. We belong to God as a sheep belong to the shepherd. And then what I love, he was willing to let his life be a service to the Lord. The message was clear from the angel. You are going to bear witness in Rome of me before Caesar. And then he had to live that life out by faith. And that's exactly what God's asked us to do. To live out our life. We sang about it, trusting him. The storms of life come. Trust him. Yet I don't know about you, but for me, so many times it's easy for that to leave my mind in the time of struggle and storm when I need it most, that I forget that my trust and my confidence needs to be in him. Trust him in the details of life. My job. My sickness. My cancer. The death of a loved one. I have no idea what kind of storms you might face. There have been storms that have come into our lives, and some have been heavy. I remember probably for me, I had some trouble as a young boy physically. I had many surgeries, and I'm always, you know, someone says, you seem to be so sympathetic when we're in the hospital and going into surgery. Trust me, I am. I've been there. I remember those days, even as a little kid. And yet, I'll never forget one of the biggest storms that just came up so quick and hit me was a few years after our first son, Kyle, was born. We were expecting our second child. And Kathy was far along, and I remember watching her walk up to the house and come in the house. I was playing with our little one, and I looked up, and I could see on her face. I said, what's wrong? She said, the doctor said we've lost the baby. I can remember that day as vivid as I stand before you this morning and in tears crying out to God saying, God, I'm thankful you're with us. Man, do we need you right now. These are difficult days. Help us to respond in a way that's going to honor and glorify you. Can I tell you, there is nothing like the presence of God to stabilize us during the stormiest moments in our lives. I think what's an interesting contrast is Jonah's attitude during a storm at sea versus the Apostle Paul's attitude at a storm during a storm at sea. Remember, Jonah was running from God. He was not on deck helping like the Apostle Paul was helping here. He was in the hold of the ship, asleep. Can I say, I think it's a sad statement. When believers are needed to come to the help and aid of other believers, and they're not there because they're asleep. And we see in verses 33 through 38 what I would refer to as this anchor of encouragement that we see that the Apostle Paul had. The angel was a great encouragement to him, and in turn, he was an encouragement to all those that were on board. And here we go. And so Paul says, look at verse 32, then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the skiff and they let it fall off. And as day was about to dawn, Paul implored them all to take food, saying, today is the 14th day you've waited and continued without food and eaten nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take nourishment, for this is for your survival, since not a hair will fall from the head of any of you. And when he had said these things, he took bread and he gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. Then they were all encouraged, and they also took food themselves. But as we keep going through this narrative in Acts 27, Paul becomes very much a central figure, and they're all wanting to listen to what he's going to say and what he has to say to them. You see, a leader has the ability to courage. And may I just say this? It shouldn't be just the duty of a leader. It should be the duty of believers that we're an encouragement to one another. I mean, when was the last time that I took time to see someone and say, you know what? I want to give them a word of encouragement. My prayer for my own life is, God, make me sensitive to your spirit and make me sensitive to the lives of people you bring into my life. The Apostle Paul was very sensitive to those others on the ship. And so he gives them some practical advice. He says, your physical well-being, you're not in good shape. You haven't eaten for 14 days. I think what a sad indictment for me is I spend one day where I'm not going to eat and I'm going to pray to the Lord. And at the end of that day, here's this been this great time with God. I'm discouraged. Why? Because I'm weak after just one day of not eating. They had 14 days that they didn't eat. You go, well, what? Why wouldn't they eat? Well, I don't care how experienced they were. When you have a storm, your rockledon hits you, there's probably some strong anxiety going on along with some seasickness. And so for 14 days, they don't eat. They're easily discouraged. They're defeated. And Paul now says, here's what I want you to do. Let's eat. And then he matches his words with actions. He takes the bread and he gives thanks to God, a spirit of gratefulness. And he took it and he ate it. And then the men took confidence, and they also ate. Can I tell you, leaders instill confidence when they are confident. You ever try to get someone to do something and you're not totally confident it's going to work? Not Paul at this point. His confidence was in God. You listen to the words of the hymn by Ira Sankey. The Lord's our rock, in him we hide. A shelter in the time of storm. Secure whatever ill betide. A shelter in the time of storm. And his confidence bleeds right over to these men. And they are encouraged, we're told in verse 36. And their physical need is met. And now they're to tackle the task. And that's get the ship ready, because they're going to run it aground. Many centuries, many miles away, during this dark storm, as they were tossed on the Mediterranean, Paul determined to make a difference to those around him. I believe his example is there for us today of some timeless truths of anchors. And the third anchor that I'd like to close with today is this anchor of absolute faith. God said it, it's going to happen. God said it, this is what I'm going to do. God said it. Verse 39, when it was day, they did not recognize the land. You say, how could that happen? How many days? It says many days. These expert seamen couldn't even see the sun. They could see no stars to help navigate their system. Why did I say at the beginning this was as miraculous as anything you've ever come across? They're in the Mediterranean being tossed to and fro. They have no idea where they are. It's miraculous because God was protecting them because he had something special he wanted to do with Paul in Rome. And because of that, everybody else along with Paul was safe. And so the prophecy of God was fulfilled. Here we go, verse 40. And they let go the anchors and they let them in the sea. Meanwhile, loosing the rudder ropes, they hoisted the mainsail to the wind, and now they made for shore. But striking a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the bow struck fast, and it remained immovable, but the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. And the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wanting to save Paul, kept them from their purpose, and he commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land. And the rest, some on boards and some on parts of the ship. And so it was that they all escaped safely to land. Miraculous, 276 start, 276 finish. Paul was used by God as a saving presence to the other prisoners. The prophecy of God was fulfilled. God's word was taken at face value, and they're saved, and the apostle was saved. The power of God had been totally demonstrated. Even through the loss of direction by these seamen, God still had a sense of direction. And through the life of the apostle Paul, we can see that God's power had been demonstrated. Sometimes God might take you or your family through the storm for the sake of other people. Our experiences may be used to teach and to encourage others. Times of testing will be of great learning. Finally, I just want to give you three great contrasts quickly. Turmoil versus inner peace. I'm telling you what, on this ship, there had to be turmoil like you wouldn't believe. And yet, in the midst of that is one man who said, my confidence is in God and in God alone. There's turmoil, there's confidence and inner peace. Vacillation versus consistency and a steady progress. They had been taking Paul, you talk about being on a yo-yo. They had been jerking him around. You try it. Nah, I don't know what to try him with. I mean, he'd go from this court to this court to this court to this. He's on this ship. Now they put him on this ship. Now he goes on another ship. They cannot figure out what to. And yet, through all of that, you see consistency and a steady progress because Paul kept his focus fixed. And finally, fear versus a faith in God. The Bible lets us know that God says, I have not given you a spirit of fear, but I've given you a spirit of power and love and of a sound mind. As believers, our confidence and our faith has to be an anchor, just as it was in Paul's day. It's a truth for us, the anchor of this absolute faith. Horatio Spafford was a well-known Christian lawyer in Chicago. He was a prosperous businessman also. And he had gone deeper in his dedication for God through the ministry of D.L. Moody there in Chicago. In 1871, the great tragedy of the fire struck Chicago, and in a matter of a few hours, much of Mr. Spafford's real estate holdings were nothing but ashes that were left. After the fire, most of young Chicago lay in ruins, and one of the first buildings erected in northern Chicago after the fire was a building built by Dr. D.L. Moody called the Northside Tabernacle. It was at this place that Mr. Spafford kept himself occupied in helping those who had lost everything, because he was fortunate to have still had his law practice, his family, and some equity left. In November of 1873, it had been 2 years and the schools had not been rebuilt. And so he thought, I think the best thing to do is to send my four daughters and my wife over to England and get them into an English academy. He was going to go with them, but just before they left, a last-minute business development made it necessary for Mr. Spafford to remain in Chicago and to send his wife and his daughters on ahead. He would come later. The Spafford family arrived safely in New York. They boarded their ship, and soon they were on their way to England. But mid-ocean, there was a collision between their ship and an English sailing ship. And the ship that the Spaffords were on floundered and sank, taking with her to the bottom of the ocean most of those on board, including Mr. Spafford's four daughters. His wife was rescued, and she was one of the survivors that they took to England. And she was able to draft a message when she got to England. And it was short, and it was sent to her husband in Chicago, and it read, "Saved alone." When Mr. Spafford received this message, the tragedy of the fire seemed but nothing in comparison to what this cablegram implied. Money and burned buildings could be replaced, but his children were gone. And it was through this storm and these dark days that Mr. Spafford eventually got on a ship to go to England to join his wife. And he asked the captain, "When we get to the place where the ship went down and my daughters died, could you let me know?" At 4 a.m., they woke him up. Mr. Spafford went out on the deck of the ship. You can imagine some of the emotions going through his mind, his heart. He penned for us these words that have been put to a song. "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot thou hast taught me to say, it is well. It is well with my soul. With God in control and some anchors that he's given to us that can hold us during these dark, stormy days, we can say with Mr. Spafford, in the midst of these times, God is in control. All is well."